Ambrose had said I'd stripped naked as well. At a party? Why is that so shocking? I demanded. He looked at my mom and they both burst out laughing. Ambrose clicked his pen open again. 5. Luna doesn't get out much. I'm going to Kirby's, I announced, pushing out my chair with a bit too much force. Now I had to grab the table to keep from rolling away. I'll call on my way back for the lunch order. With this, I collected my purse and walked out of the conference room, making it clear decisions had been made. And I really did feel that way, all the way to the front door of the office. Then my mother called my name. I turned back to see her standing by the reception area. Her voice was low, confidential, as she came closer, then said, I need you to take Ambrose with you. Why? Because we have a very high-strung bride coming in here in 5 minutes, followed by a potential client whose wedding could make us a lot of money. We won't be able to supervise and can't risk another tape explosion. I don't understand why you hired him, I said. Because his mother asked me to and swore he could actually be a good worker if directed appropriately. I made a face, conveying my doubt about this. Other than me and William, you're the best director I know. Don't kiss up to me. It's embarrassing. She smiled. You know, you might find you actually enjoy having company. I don't dislike people, I said. I'm just not fond of him. This was an important distinction, I felt. But she barely seemed to hear me, already turning to call his name as she gestured for him to join us. He brought the pen and pad with him, of course. They're expecting you by 10 sharp, she told me, handing over her copy of the invoice. Make sure you get everything. I took the paper from her, not answering, and turned back to the door. Before I could push it open, though, he reached around and did it for me. After you. My first thought was to just stop in my tracks right where I was. The next was how petulant I was acting, like a child. Strange how you could barely know a person and they were still able to bring out the worst in you. I took a breath, nodded at him, then stepped through the door. Up close, I saw there was another tiny pink boa feather in his hair. He would not stop touching everything. It had started with the vents, which he spent the first 5 minutes of the drive, I was watching the dashboard clock, turning this way and that to achieve what he referred to as maximum cooling velocity. Then he moved on to his side of the dual thermostat dial, turning it to basically Arctic, followed by loosening and tightening his seatbelt. Now it was the radio. Stop, I said as he changed the station yet again. When he'd asked if he could, I'd said yes, thinking he'd do it once or twice. This was our 4th round of my presets, and my headache was increasing with each push of a button. Just leave it on one thing, would you please?
I can't listen to bad music, he explained. It's like a thing with me.
Fine. I hit the AM/FM button. Talk radio it is. I realized my mistake almost instantly. As it was the top of the hour, the national news was on.
Authorities have released the names of the 5 victims of yesterday's shooting in California.
The reporter's voice, seemingly like everyone on public radio, was level and calm.
All were students at Riverton High School, as was the gunman, a 16-year-old male who was a sophomore. Classmates and teachers have stated he was quiet, but showed no previous signs of violence.
I took a breath, focusing on my hands on the wheel. Ambrose was messing with his seatbelt again.
15-year-old Lacey Turnquist was a neighbor of the shooter.
The voice continued. Then that of a girl, speaking quickly, breathless. He wasn't a bad kid, but he did get picked on some. I never thought he'd do something like this, though. Never in a million years. The reporter again.
The shooter's name has not yet been released to the media. In Russia, government officials...
I hit the button again, bringing us back to music.
Ambrose looked over. Now who's messing with the radio?
I didn't answer. Instead, just focusing on breathing and driving. He reached out to turn the AC down another notch.
Crazy about that shooting, huh? I watched some of the coverage with Millie's mom this morning when she made us pancakes. Heavy stuff.
A truck switched lanes in front of me, and I hit the brakes, giving it space. Who's Millie?
Oh, just this girl from last night. I crashed on her couch.
He tugged at his belt again.
They were saying the kid had a fixation on other school shootings.
I realized I was gripping the steering wheel. 10 and 2, I thought, moving my hands on the wheel.
Like he'd done a report on that one in Brownwood, stood up in front of a current events class and talked all about it. How creepy is that?
I swallowed, suddenly aware of the prickly feeling space between my ears. The truck switched back to the other lane.
I can't... Seriously, me neither. I mean, I didn't love high school either, but come on. No need to take it out on everyone else.
A pause.
Hey, are you okay?
I wasn't. But I was also behind the wheel in heavy traffic and knew to acknowledge this would be the worst thing I could do.
Why?
I began. Then heard a crack in my voice. I swallowed.
Why didn't you like high school?
He pushed the curl aside.
Well, it was really myriad reasons. First, I don't do well in standardized learning environments. Also, I have problems with conventional forms of authority and a compromised attention span and can be super annoying.
As if to underline this, he changed the radio station again.
Those are direct quotes, by the way.
From counselors?
And teachers. Psychiatrists. Peer evaluations.
Your peers said you were annoying, I assume?
Nope. That was one of my shrinks.
I raised my eyebrows.
I know. I was like, wait, that's not a doctor term. Is annoying a diagnosis now? And if so, can I get meds for it?
He laughed then, in a can-you-even-believe-it kind of way, shaking his head. Then he looked out the window, drumming his fingers on one knee. I could see my exit now, the one that would take us onto the two-lane road that made up the rest of the trip. I put on my blinker, switching lanes so carefully you would have thought I was taking the driving test with a DMV worker beside me. Only when we reached the top of the ramp, the heavy traffic now a distant roar below, did I realize I'd been holding my breath. Keep talking, I told myself.
Did you really go home with one of those girls last night?
He stretched the seatbelt away from him, then let it snap back.
Well, yes, in the technical sense, but nothing really happened. I crashed on her couch, and in the morning her mom came out in her bathrobe and offered me breakfast.
Doesn't B worry when you don't come home?
Nah, I check in. And remember, I'm annoying. She needs a break every now and then.
She seems like a really nice girl, I said.
She is.
He said this simply. It was clear it was fact.
It's not easy always having to be the good one, but she's a natural. You have any siblings?
I shook my head.
Nope, just me and my mom. Huh,
he said. Don't ask, I told myself.
Then I asked.
What?
Nothing,
he said. I waited, making it clear I expected more.
Just that, you know, it explains things. How you like to be alone.
I don't like to be alone, I said.
Right. You just don't want to be with me.
I looked over at him. That's not exactly true.
Right. You basically did all you could to not have to be with me right now, including telling your mom you don't like me,
he pointed out. I blinked, surprised. He'd been in another room, after all.
He said, my annoyingness does not affect my hearing. I'm like a dog, it's so good. I'll have to remember that. I cleared my throat. Anyway, I'm sorry I said that. It's just, I'm used to working alone, and
look, you don't have to explain yourself, he said easily. I'm not for everyone.
Again, this was said with such ease, a plain truth. What was it like to be so confident even in your failings that you weren't the least bit bothered when other people pointed them out? I was almost envious. We were close to Kirby's now. I could see the greenhouses, as well as the bursts of color that were their outdoor plantings in the distance. When it came to florists, my mom only recommended the best, usually choosing companies that catered to the exact needs of the client. If you wanted perfect, sculpted centerpieces of roses and lilies, picking Lakeview Florist or Occasions was easy. But if your taste was more natural, bohemian, wildflowers and mason jars, increasingly popular among younger brides, Kirby's was the place. I pulled into the dusty lot, right up to the squat building that housed the office. This was a family business, another reason my mom preferred them. If you called with a problem, there was no corporate voicemail system, just a hand cupping the receiver while someone bellowed for Mr. or Mrs. Kirby, who were usually out in the fields tending the plants themselves. Okay, I said, reaching back for my bag and pulling out the invoice. We're here for Gerbera daisies, glads, lilies, and sunflowers. 10 buckets total. Mrs. Kirby will always try to add on an extra bucket or two she's trying to move, but we don't have room, so we have to be firm.
10 buckets, he repeated. Gerberas, glads, sunflowers, lilies, no extras.
Huh, maybe he was right about that hearing. Correct. It shouldn't take longer than a half hour total if we don't get caught up talking.
Keep it short. All business. 30 minutes max.
My phone rang then. Jilly, most likely wanting to catch up while en route from one Kit Kat activity to another. As I hit ignore, preferring to wait until I was alone, Ambrose said,
Wait, what was that? Your ringtone.
Nothing, I told him.
It sounded like this awful pop song.
Nope, let's go. I pushed open my door, getting out as he did the same, then followed me through the propped open screen door. Inside, rows of plants sat on makeshift tables made of sawhorses and plywood, a row of walk-in coolers along one wall.
Luna Barrett!
A woman's voice came from behind a tall basket of ornamental greenery.
Right on time, as always.
Hey, Mrs. Kirby, I replied. How are you? She stepped out, wiping her hands on her apron. She was a tall and broad black woman with a melodic voice, and everything she said sounded important.
Very good, very good. Have some gorgeous peonies I want to show you on special, your mom's favorite.
They are, I agreed, but space is tight.
You can always make room for a few extra blooms,
she replied, then noticed Ambrose.
Who's this? A boyfriend?
No, I said a bit too quickly. This is Ambrose. He's working with us for the summer.
Oh, well, I'm sure you can forgive me for getting hopeful that you might have found another romantic prospect.
She turned to him, shaking her head. So heartbreaking what happened with that boy of hers. This was so unexpected that for a moment, I couldn't even respond. Mrs. Kirby was a talker, always had been. The previous fall, I'd come out here to collect a client's rehearsal dinner flowers, and, in an unusual move for me, everything when it came to Ethan was different, mentioned I had a boyfriend. It was almost embarrassing thinking back to how happy I'd been, how I'd worked this fact and him into just about any conversation. When she asked after him the next time I saw her, I was so raw I told the truth. Both mistakes. Big ones. Ambrose was looking at me. This he couldn't miss, even without the good hearing. I said, "We're really kind of pressed for time, and my mom wants pictures before we pack up the car. Can we go ahead and look at what you have?"
Mrs. Kirby, like any long-winded person, was used to being redirected.
"Of course, sweetie, whatever you want," she said. "But you have to see these peonies. I can't let you leave without at least a glimpse."
She started toward the back, and I immediately fell in behind her, making a point of not looking Ambrose's way at all. Whatever was on his face as he worked this out, or guessed at it, surprise, pity, empathy, I knew I did not want to see it. I would take annoying instead all day long.
45 minutes later, we were pulling back onto the two-lane highway, 11 buckets of flowers strapped with bungee cords into the back of my banged-up Suburban. I'd caved on the peonies, mostly just because I didn't have it in me to face down the hard sell. And they were beautiful, fragile and fragrant with lacy edges. They'd look gorgeous in the jars I'd be unpacking and cleaning later that day for Charlotte MacDonald's wedding, and if she didn't agree, I'd eat the cost myself. They were my mom's favorite. I kept waiting for Ambrose to ask me about Ethan. While we waited for Mrs. Kirby to confer with her husband, who came in from the fields in overalls and a straw hat, about prices. As we carted the buckets to the car, arranging them like a puzzle to make everything fit snugly. And now, when we were finally alone and back on the road, the car around us so fragrant that I had to crack my window. But he didn't. Instead, he messed with the vents again, the seatbelt, the radio. Also, he sneezed. It happened, especially when you weren't used to so many flowers in such a small space. Over the course of about 3 miles, I went from dreading him bringing it up to just wishing he would. At least then, it would be happening and not about to happen. After another mile, I figured I'd just go ahead and tell him to get it over with. "Can we stop?" he asked suddenly, nodding at a little store that was just ahead. "I'm parched." Of course he couldn't just say thirsty, I thought, annoyed. "Sure," I said, glancing at the dashboard clock. "We have to be quick, though." The store was small and dusty, an older man behind the counter. As soon as we walked in, a dog approached us, quickly wagging its tail. It was skinny and small, its fur scruffy, poking out in wiry tufts above its eyebrows and around the snout, kind of like a canine Brillo pad. Panting. Ambrose immediately dropped down to greet it, which made it even more excited, its entire body twisting and writhing as it got petted. "Your dog is awesome!" he called out to the man, who was reading a newspaper, a pencil behind his ear. In return, he just grunted. I walked over to the drink cooler, pulling out an iced tea. "What do you want?" I asked Ambrose, who was busy scratching the dog's neck, making one leg bang excitedly against the floor.
"Something fruity with lots of sugar,"
he replied.
I know, you are a good boy."
This time the man looked over, irritated, and I was surprised to feel a wave of protectiveness. It was a fact Ambrose got on people's nerves, but this guy had only been around him a few seconds. I grabbed a tropical punch that was bright pink, then took both drinks over to the counter, putting them down. Just as I did, a car beeped outside and the dog started barking, the noise sudden and high-pitched.
"Shut up!"
the man growled as he punched a few buttons on the register.
"Goddamn dog!
472.
I gave him a 5, highly aware as the noise continued, a mix of a yip and a screech.
"Hey, buddy,"
Ambrose was saying.
"It's okay."
"Barks every time he hears a beep,"
the man said, pushing my change across to me.
"And it's like nails on a chalkboard."
I said nothing to this, just took the drinks and started for the door. "Let's go," I said to Ambrose, who was still trying to quiet the dog down. "There's bound to be traffic." Another series of yaps, one right after the other. The man pushed himself to his feet, grumbling under his breath, then came around the counter, walking with a noticeable limp over to a back door.
Out! He said to the dog as he pushed it open. Go play in traffic!
The dog got quiet and sat down.
Good boy, Ambrose told him.
The man sighed.
Out!
He said again, this time snapping his fingers. Slowly, the dog stood, then walked out the door, and the man dropped it shut behind him. As he shuffled back behind the counter, Ambrose tracked him with his eyes. Come on, I said quietly. A beat, then another. Finally, he followed me outside. We got in the car and I cranked the engine, then handed him his drink. I'd just shifted into reverse when he said,
Hey, I need a bathroom break, long ride ahead and all.
We're already back in the car, I said.
I'll hurry, promise.
I sat back. Quickly, he unbuckled his seatbelt and hopped out, walking around the building toward the sign that said, Restrooms. I was just reaching forward to change the radio station, now an addiction for both of us, clearly, when the passenger door suddenly opened again and he tumbled inside.
Go!
He said. He was holding something in his arms.
What? Go! Drive! Now!
It was only after I shifted into reverse again, for some reason blindly following this directive, that I looked over and saw that what he was clutching was, in fact, the dog.
Ambrose, you stole that man's dog? I prefer to look at it as a rescue,
he corrected me as it wriggled wildly in my side vision. I looked over my shoulder.
Are you serious right now? I couldn't just leave him there,
he said, as if I was the one acting irrationally.
Can you go a little faster? Just until we're clear of the parking lot?
I glanced in the rear view, but of course no one was following us. Still, I hit the gas hard as I pulled out, spraying gravel. The dog started barking again.
See how happy he is?
Ambrose asked, as we picked up speed. He rolled down his window and the dog immediately stuck his head out, the wind ruffling the bursts of hair over his eyes. I looked over at both of them, then in the rear view, where now all I could see was flowers bobbing in the breeze. Only then did I realize minutes had passed since I'd been thinking about Ethan and having to tell Ambrose that story. This should have made me happy, I knew, or at least relieved. But instead I felt sad. Sometimes forgetting was just as bad as remembering.
Is that a dog? I'd been worried about catching flack for the peonies.
But as I lugged them in the office's back door, my mom didn't even notice.
Yep, I said, brushing past her to put the bucket down. Do you want these all here together?
Sure, she said, watching Ambrose as he tied an old scarf I'd found in my back seat around the dog's neck. The dog, who had not calmed down one bit during the hour drive, kept trying to lick him. I walked back to the van, pulling open the other door and reaching for a bucket of tall gladiolas in bright pinks and purples. A moment later, Ambrose was beside me, removing the Gerbera daisies.
I think he's thirsty, he said to me. You think I can grab him some water?
My mom's not exactly an animal person, I advised him. We both looked over at her. She was studying the dog as it gnawed on the scarf.
Whatever you do, I'd proceed with caution. Right. Thanks.
We went inside, putting the buckets down. Glancing into the conference room, I saw William at the table, unloading mason jars from a cardboard box. He called out,
Did you bring lunch? I'm starving.
One sec, I told him. We're just getting the flowers in. He glanced around me, out at the car and Ambrose.
Is that?
Yes, my mother, still in the doorway, told him. They brought a dog back, too, which was not on the list. I grabbed a bottled water from a nearby counter, along with a plastic thermos cup that had long ago lost its bottom half. When I went back outside,
Ambrose was at the van, pulling out the sunflowers. "Here," I said, handing them both to him. "Just try to keep things low-key."
"I always do,"
he said cheerfully. I couldn't tell if he was kidding. I unloaded the lunch stuff, then left William and Mom at the table with their salads and went back outside, where the dog was now lapping water out of the thermos top. When he saw me, he stopped, lifting his dripping snout, and started wagging his tail.
"He likes you,"
Ambrose told me. "I smell like lunch," I replied, not quite convinced. Still, I bent down, scratching the brittle hairs behind the dog's ears. The truth was, I wasn't much of an animal person. I remembered a time, back in first grade, when I'd wanted a cat or dog more than anything. But my mom worked so much, and she claimed her former life on the farm had been quite enough animal caretaking, thank you, so eventually I stopped asking. It wasn't that I didn't like pets, I just figured they were for other people, like nose piercings and gluten-free diets. Ambrose, however, felt differently. It was obvious by the way he was watching the dog drink, as if he was both adorable and genius.
"I didn't hear him get called anything, did you? Guess that means we can name him whatever we want."
"We?" I thought. Out loud, I said, "What's Bee going to say about this?"
"Oh, she'll be fine. She loves animals."
The dog finished off the water, then sat back and shook its jowls, sending droplets flying.
"And anyway, she won't have to deal with him. He'll go everywhere with me."
"On foot," I said, clarifying. He nodded. "What's going to happen when you crash at people's houses, like last night?"
"This is a small dog," he replied. "Compact. Won't be a problem."
"You'll have to feed it and take it to the vet, make sure it's healthy, and what about in the fall when you go back to school?" He looked at me then.
"You think way ahead, don't you?"
"No," I said, although I couldn't see why this was a bad thing. "I just think. I don't just take a dog and deal with the consequences later."
"Right now, there aren't consequences, though," he replied. "There's just a happy dog. What do you think about the name Jerry?"
The dog leaned down and began licking the empty bowl hard enough to make it scrape against the pavement. "Why didn't you ask me about what Mrs. Kirby said?" It was like I'd both planned to say this and totally had not. My discomfort earlier, when this discussion had seemed inevitable, had passed with all the excitement of the abduction and ensuing ride home. Now I didn't feel like I just wanted to get it over with. Instead, I was genuinely curious. Ambrose clearly had no problems traversing or outright bursting over any other boundaries in conversation or otherwise. So why not this one?
"You mean about your boyfriend?" he said.
"Yeah."
"Did you want me to ask?"
"No," I said. "I never do. I hate talking about it, but that's never stopped you before."
"Are we already at a point where our relationship is in nevers?" he asked. That was fast.
"You know what I mean."
"I'm not sure I do."
He stood, the dog watching him, tail still wagging.
"Look, Luna, I might be a dog stealer, as far as you're concerned, but I am able to follow the basic rules of civility. If I was going to talk about a bad breakup, I'd want to be the one to bring it up. You did not."
"A bad breakup?" I thought. Then I said, "I don't always have the choice."
"Clearly. So why would I make it worse by then pushing for more details? People will tell you what they want you to know. I'm annoying, not an asshole."
I had to admit this was not what I was expecting, but as I went back over what Mrs. Kirby had said again, I realized it made sense he'd drawn this conclusion. Everyone had breakups they didn't want to talk about. Why would he assume it was anything else? As if to punctuate the moment, the dog burped, spitting water. I opened my mouth to say something, to respond, but realized, again to my surprise, that I had a lump in my throat. I swallowed. "I don't think he's a Jerry."
No?
He squatted down, giving the dog another scratch.
You might be right. No worries. He'll tell us his name when he wants us to know it.
He'll tell us?
Well, in his way.
He patted his head.
Stay here. I promise I'll come back, okay?
In response, the dog wagged its entire back end. As we walked away, it was still going full speed. It was the shortest of walks back to the conference room, not nearly enough time to explain what I'd been thinking when I asked him about what Mrs. Kirby had said. The truth was, I felt I owed it to Ethan that he not be just a boy I once loved, much less one more face in a news story you dreaded having to hear. He was more than that, and yet talking about him to others felt, too often, like appropriating something. What did it take to claim a person, really? One perfect night? A few weeks of phone calls, hundreds of texts, all of them full of future plans and promises made? I'd spent less than a day with Ethan, but still felt he knew me better than just about anyone. You can't measure love by time put in, but the weight of those moments. Some in life are light, like a touch. Others, you can't help but stagger beneath. This was on my mind all afternoon as Ambrose and I rinsed mason jars, packed them with flowers, then put them in lined boxes to be transported to the armory for table decor at the rehearsal dinner. Occasionally, he went to check on the dog, bringing him snacks, more water, an old dish towel I'd found under the sink to curl up on, but otherwise we worked in silence. "People will tell you what they want you to know," he'd said. If that was true, I would have brought up Ethan right away, not just with him, but everyone I met. That's what you do about the best thing that's ever happened to you. Unless, I guess, it is also the worst. At 6 p.m., Mom and William left for the venue, releasing us to our respective evenings. I was expecting to be asked to transport Ambrose and the dog to wherever their next place might be, but then, as I was locking up, a black VW Jetta pulled up at the curb. A pretty redhead with seriously ripped shoulders, wearing yoga clothes, sunglasses perched on her head, was behind the wheel. "Hey," she called out to me. "I'm looking for Ambrose." "He's around back," I replied. "Should be out in a sec." "Thanks." She smiled, then pulled down her mirror, taking out a lip gloss and applying a coat. Was this Millie? Someone else? Of course, I wouldn't ask. He hadn't told me. A moment later, Ambrose came around the corner holding the scarf, the dog lunging excitedly at the opposite end.
"Annika!" he said. "Namaste!"
she smiled.
"I didn't know you had a dog."
"I am full of surprises."
He climbed into the passenger seat, then patted his lap. As the dog leapt in, Annika burst out laughing, reaching over to rub his head with one hand. Ambrose waved at me, and I nodded, then started over to my own car. When I looked back a moment later, they were pulling out of the lot, the dog's head poking out the window. On the way home, I changed the radio station 6 times before I decided, finally, on silence. Chapter 8. "Okay, so that's the Big Dipper," I said, pointing. "See how it looks like a ladle? And below it is the Little Dipper, and under that, the little one that looks like a crown? That's Cassiopeia." Ethan turned his head to the side. I felt his hair brush my cheek.
"And what about that one?"
"Which?" He lifted his arm, moving a finger in a circle.
"That clump there, at the bottom."
"I have no idea." He shifted again, this time facing me.
"I thought you said you knew this stuff."
"Some of it," I said, rolling toward him as well. "Okay, I know those 3. He laughed, that sudden burst that was even more startling close up.
And here I thought you could get us home strictly by celestial navigation.
Nope, we'd be screwed, I told him. Sorry.
Hey, at least you can name a few. I've always just made up my own.
Your own constellations?
Sure, it's like inkblots. You can tell a lot about a person by what they see in the sky.
He moved onto his back again.
Take that weird square over there. I'd call that dented laundry hamper.
It just doesn't have the same ring as Cassiopeia.
But it's clear what it is. He pointed again. Okay, and that one, over on the left, that's dish scrubber.
Now that I looked, I could sort of see the resemblance. So what does it say about you that so far it's all household items that you see?
I'm glad you asked, he replied, and I smiled, already recognizing this as a classic Ethan expression. I think it speaks to my domesticity, also lack of imagination.
What about that one? I asked, lifting my finger to point. He didn't even hesitate.
Potholder.
And that, the cluster by the Big Dipper?
EKG.
That's not a household item.
Well, maybe not at your house.
This time I laughed, and as I did, he reached up, taking my pointing finger and pulling it toward him. I shifted my grip, interlocking my hand with his as he placed it on his chest, then curled up against him. After the dance, sweet, awkward, perfect, we'd walked past the end of the world, through the shifting tides. It was then he'd taken my hand, wordless, easily. A stretch of dark, damp sand later, we found ourselves on the other side of the Colby Peninsula. When the lights of the boardwalk appeared in the distance, we both stopped walking.
Not yet, he said,
and I knew exactly what he meant. We sat down and started looking at the stars. I'd always been nervous about boys. I wasn't like Jilly, coming alive when faced with the opposite sex, the very presence of a guy causing the inherent glow in her to brighten. Instead, I was always jumpy, too aware of the particulars, the mechanics of a hand on mine or an arm over my shoulder, the way my lips fit his in a kiss, specifics of saliva and tongue as if I was being graded on form. The kind of passion and attraction I saw in movies or read about in books seemed impossible to me, entirely too fraught with details and elbows. From the start, Ethan was different. I felt so comfortable with him. Even just standing near him, there at the breaking waves, I'd wanted to lean in closer. It was the same way I felt now as he reached his free hand to smooth back my hair. When he kissed me, I thought of nothing but how he tasted. For the rest of that night, in my memory anyway, we were always in contact. My hand in his arm over my shoulder, the easy way he cupped my waist to pull me against him as we lay there in the sand, and later crossed the length of the empty beach. We walked for an hour, maybe longer, talking the entire time, before we finally came up on the boardwalk. Everything seemed bright and different after so long in the darkness, even though most of the businesses were closed. There was one neon sign lit, however, in the window of a narrow storefront. Coffee and pie, it read. Two bikes were parked just outside. I looked at Ethan.
We have to, he said, answering the question I hadn't even asked.
I shook the sand out of my shoes, then dropped them onto the boards beneath my feet. My hair felt wild as I tried to smooth it, my lips raw from kissing. When I looked up at Ethan, I saw sand along his temple.
Hold on, I said, reaching up.
As I did, he lowered his head, leaning into my fingers. It was such a simple, fleeting moment, but later, when I'd think of it, I would sob until my chest ached. The big moments with Ethan weren't, well, big.
Instead, it was these tiny increments and gestures that I clung to in order to hold on to him. It was why, now, I was never able to tell this story all at once. My memory fractured in certain places, wanting to just stop right there. On the boardwalk, in the throne light of a neon sign. His head dipped down as I pulled my fingers through his hair, sand falling onto my feet. That night still in progress, with daylight hours away.
Chapter 9.
Now?
No.
A pause.
Now?
I shook my head. Another pause. Then finally, William gave me the nod.
Okay,
I said slowly. Now! Ambrose leaned down over the ring-bearer, a kindergartner named Ira, saying,
Okay, dude, it's go time.
He rubbed his shoulders like a boxer's trainer, about to send him into the ring.
You got this! Walk!
I sighed as Ira, in his tiny tux, carrying a white satin pillow with the two rings very loosely sewn on, started forward. In BRR, my mom reached into her pocket for some M&Ms. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I counted, then nodded at Ambrose. He said something to the two flower girls, both redheads and plentifully freckled, that made them giggle, then gave them the go-ahead. The older one began tossing rose petals carefully, as I demonstrated. The younger threw most of hers out in one big clump. Well, you couldn't have everything.
Oh my God, y'all, I'm so nervous!
Julie, the maid of honor, said loudly as the first bridesmaid and groomsmen began their walk. My mother and William had christened her an SS, Spotlight Stealer, at the rehearsal dinner the night before, when her speech stretched to 20 minutes, only ending with her sobbing happy tears, reportedly much to the bride's obvious annoyance. Weddings were like truth serum, or so my mom always said. Whatever your personality, it would come out in spades.
Does anybody have a mint?
Julie said.
I'm serious. I need a mint.
I was reaching into my pocket for one when Ambrose beat me to it, stepping back beside her as the next couple from the party began walking.
The flavor is cool waterfall,
he told her, holding out a roll.
I find it both surprising and refreshing.
Oh, bless you!
Julie helped herself to one, popping it into her mouth, then smoothed back her hair.
Do I look okay? I'm a wreck!
The groomsman she'd been paired with rolled his eyes. Short and stubby with a red face, he had a whiny wife plus two small children who'd been running around like wild animals. I'd seen him taking multiple gulps from a flask during lineup, either thinking no one would notice or just not caring. There were lives you envied, I guess, and those you didn't.
You're stunning,
Ambrose told her, as I walked back to where the bride, Charlotte, was standing with her father, blinking rapidly as she looked ahead at the packed church.
Excited?
I said to her, the word we used instead of nervous. She nodded, blinking again.
You're going to do great. Remember, it's supposed to be fun.
I saw her face relax, slightly. I'd take what I could get. And then Julie's voice drifted back to us.
Oh, God, I'm next. I'm a total wreck. Does anyone have a tissue?
Charlotte tensed right back up, a full body clench. Her dad glared. Ambrose, oblivious, gave Julie a tissue. I looked ahead, into the church. In the back row, my mom was looking right at the bride. I had no doubt that even from a distance, she was following this entire exchange solely by body cues and expressions. By the time she turned her attention to me, I was already sliding in closer to Charlotte, cupping a hand on her elbow. You look gorgeous, I told her. She and her dad were the only ones left now, Julie and her groomsmen halfway down the aisle. And remember, this is your day.
I'm going to fucking kill her tomorrow, she declared through gritted teeth.
Her lipstick was perfect. And not a soul would blame you, I replied smoothly. Ready to get married? She sucked in a breath as I bent down, fluffing out the beaded train of her ivory, full-skirted dress one last time. When I stood, I saw Julie up at the front of the church, dramatically dabbing her eyes as the photographer, oblivious, moved in for the candid shot. As the organ began again, William, stealthy like a shark, moved in to say something to Julie. Then everyone stood, blocking my view.
Wow, Ambrose said a few minutes later, after we'd eased shut the back doors of the church, then taken our places by the side entrance where we'd wait to corral everyone post-ceremony. That was intense. It's like coordinating an explosion.
We might have had one if Julie had kept talking, I told him. In the future, remember, we only use words like stunning for the bride in the bride's earshot.
Oh, sorry, he said. She seemed like she needed some confidence.
She's a desperate attention seeker who had no qualms about hijacking her so-called best friend's wedding, I replied. The worst thing you can do is give someone like that attention.
And a mint is attention?
If you don't offer them to the bride first.
Do you realize you sound like a crazy person?
Suddenly William appeared behind us, slightly out of breath from taking the outside route around the church.
Jesus, that maid of honor is a piece of work.
Did you see those soap opera tears?
I half expected her to swan into a faint and stop the whole ceremony.
I smiled. What did you say to her?
I told her to shape up, remember who she was there for, and do her job.
He shook his head, annoyed. We're going to have to watch her at the reception. $5 says she inflicts bodily harm, diving for the bouquet. I bet she's dying to get married, I mused as, up front, Charlotte and her groom took each other's hands. I couldn't see Julie at all.
And nobody will have her because she's so obnoxious, William said.
Always a bridesmaid, until nobody even asks you to do that anymore. I was so used to this kind of exchange, having it was like breathing. So I didn't notice until we paused that Ambrose was watching us, his expression aghast.
You guys are horrible, he said.
Did I try to upstage a wedding just now? I asked.
Was I the one yelling loudly about a mint just seconds before my best friend walked down the aisle?
William said. Ambrose just looked at us. I said, he's got super hearing, too. William pulled out his phone, glancing at the screen.
Your mom's reporting a loud talker. I'll be back.
I stepped back, giving him room to slip around us and down the side aisle to a row close to the front, where he slid in on the end. A beat, then a very pointed expression to a woman in a flowered dress a few people down from him. I got quiet, and I wasn't even saying anything.
It's so weird to me, Ambrose said as the vows began, how you can be so cynical in this job. Aren't weddings all about hope?
Marriages are about hope, I said. Weddings are pure logistics.
Is he married?
He asked, nodding at William, who was now studying the younger flower girl as she fidgeted, tugging at the zipper of her dress. Nope, I said. He's never even gotten close. The last boyfriend was the dad of one of my friends, and that was all the way back in middle school. I had a flash of Mr. Bobkin, Eleanor Bobkin's dad, newly divorced, who had met William at one of my choral performances in 7th grade. They'd dated for about 3 months. Mr. Bobkin had started talking about shopping for furniture together, and William fled. Since then, there'd been no one except the occasional fling, usually on vacations he took with his friends.
But I only got sparse details on those via eavesdropping, and sadly, William could always hear me coming.
What about your mom? Ambrose asked.
Same way. Dateless for years, no faith in the power of love and romance. Realizing this sounded harsh, even to me, I added, Look, the wedding business jades a person. Clearly, this is only your first. By the end of the summer, you'll probably be just as bad as we are.
He was watching Charlotte as she said her vows, a smile on her face.
We? You feel that way, too?
I shrugged. I'm not totally cynical, but I don't believe in the fairy tale, if that's what you're asking.
The fairy tale? What's that?
A ripple across the crowd as the groom laughed, the priest joining in. The idea that everything will be perfect forever.
Nobody really believes that, though.
They do, though, I said. These brides, they come in with their new engagement rings all shiny on their fingers, and they want the ideal day. Flowers, food, venue, music, even napkins have to be perfect. And we do it because that's our job and we're good at it. But the marriage, that's up to them. And it takes a lot more than putting peonies in mason jars.
Ambrose considered this as the priest spoke at the front of the church.
You know, if you really think about it, I should be the one who doesn't believe in all this, he said after a moment. I've only been to 3 weddings, all my mother's. I was in every one of them. Each ended in divorce.
This is the first wedding you've attended that you weren't in?
Yep, he replied. It's like seeing the man behind the curtain. And that man is scary.
Sorry, I said.
But that's the thing, he replied. It's okay, because when I do get asked to another wedding, I won't go into it thinking about everything that can go wrong. I'll just enjoy the party and the moment.
Good for you. I wish I could, I said.
You can, though.
Nope. Too late. I cleared my throat.
That ship has sailed. Once you see how things can go, you can't unknow it. I felt him look at me and realized this sounded harsh. But it was the truth. It took a lot to have hope in this world where so little evidence of it existed. We may all start in the same place, at a church, watching a couple begin a whole new life together. But what we glimpse beyond that is different for each of us, a funhouse mirror reflection of our own experience. Maybe if nothing bad had ever happened, you didn't even consider those clouds and storms ahead. But for the rest of us, even the brightest sunshine carried a chance of rain. It was only a matter of time.
Interloper at 10 o'clock, I said to Ambrose. Want to take this one?
Sure,
he replied, moving over to intercept an older man making a beeline for the buffet despite our repeated reminders that we'd be going by tables. My mother hated a long, snaky line of hungry guests, but there were always the few who tried to circumvent the system. I watched, somewhat proud, as he politely redirected the man to his seat. When he flashed me a thumbs up, though, I only nodded. 2 hours into the event, I had to admit my mom had, again, been right. He was a fast learner, with the charm that initially bugged me actually being an asset at times like this. If you're going to come between someone bold enough to jump the line and the prime rib, you have to do it with a light touch, and Ambrose had that in spades. So I'd let him do the heavy lifting while I kept the lines of people who were actually supposed to be eating moving smoothly. Half the room down, half to go. This was me being optimistic, I realized, taking note of it for once. And just like that, the universe noticed as well.
Excuse me?
I turned to see a woman in a red dress approaching, a toddler with pigtails on her hip. She was thin and angular, with black framed glasses you just knew cost a fortune.
Have you seen my son? He's the ring bearer.
Ira? I asked. She nodded, switching her daughter to her other side.
I haven't seen him since the wedding party came in.
She turned.
I thought he was with his cousins over there at the kids' table, but they haven't seen him either. Where is he?
I scanned the room. No sign of a kid in a tight-fitting tux.
Let me check the lobby. Maybe he went to the bathroom. Not by himself,
she replied, gesturing to what I assumed was her husband, a heavy-set guy at the nearby bar. Now, she mouthed, and he started over.
People are hungry, Ambrose said as he walked back up to me. I just almost came to fisticuffs with a woman. She was clutching a plate and prepared to use it.
Normally, I would have questioned the use of fisticuffs. Sometimes I wondered what era Ambrose actually came from, but there was no time.
Have you seen Ira?
Little dude?
I nodded.
No. Why?
He may be missing. I said this in a low voice. The last thing we needed was unnecessary panic.
I'm going to check the lobby. You take outside.
Ira!
The mother yelled. So much for staying calm.
Has anyone seen my son?
I walked quickly to the lobby, Ambrose right behind me. As I turned down a nearby hallway, he headed for the outside doors. Older couple, clump of teenagers, probably up to no good, staff member pushing a laundry cart. No Ira. Outside the men's bathroom, I knocked hard, then pushed open the door.
Ira, are you in there?
Who?
Someone yelled back.
A kid in a tux. Do you see him?
A pause.
Nope, just me, as far as I can tell.
I let the door drop, regrouping, then pulled out my phone. Ring bearer missing. I texted my mom and William. In lobby looking. Then I headed back toward the ballroom, scanning around me as I went. Outside, I could see Ambrose in the parking lot, his hands cupped to his mouth.
Ira!
I recognized William's voice before I took a corner, almost crashing into him. He said,
Definitely not in the ballroom. Mom's starting to freak.
Bathroom's clear. I'll go help Ambrose look outside.
Your mom's sweeping the kitchen. I'll ask at the desk and do another pass through here.
We broke, neither of us running. Yet. As I pushed open the heavy glass doors to the parking lot, I could hear Ambrose.
Ira! Buddy! You out here?
Somewhere, a dog barked. I heard my phone beep and grabbed it. My mom, to all of us. No sign yet. Anyone? Shit, I thought, just as a big truck rumbled by on the street outside. Hearing a voice behind me, I swung around, but it was only a couple in formal wear, obviously late, hurrying toward the front entrance.
Ira!
I called. The dog barked again.
He's not in this lot, Ambrose reported, jogging toward me. I've cased the whole place. Twice.
Mom says he's not anywhere they've checked either, I said.
This could be bad.
Ira!
Another dog bark. Ambrose turned toward the sound.
Ira!
Bark.
Ira!
I called.
Bark.
This way, he said, starting to walk again. I followed him, checking between cars, God forbid, as I went. My phone beeped again. Mom wants police, William reported. Uh-oh.
Ira!
I called again, hearing a subsequent woof as I followed Ambrose's blue shirt around some hedges to a loading bay bright with floodlights. Now I was running, my flats slapping the pavement. We passed a dumpster and some smelly garbage cans before I spotted Ambrose's dog tied to a drainpipe. Beside him was Ira, patting his back.
Oh, my God, I said, slowing to a walk as I pulled out my phone. Found him,
I texted.
Ira, what are you doing all the way out here?
He turned, looking at us. The dog, seeing Ambrose, immediately got to his feet and began wiggling.
I saw a dog,
Ira explained.
I love dogs.
Of course you do,
I replied, walking over to a nearby door and pulling it open. startling a table of people talking just on his other side. I scanned the ballroom until I found my mom, then gave her the high sign. As she started hurrying over, Ira's mom in tow, I said,